Hi, I'm Steve Dace. So if you're looking for a summer worldview camp, this is the place to be. July 16th through the 20th, we're going to encourage your kids to become the next generation of cultural leaders. We've got pastors like Douglas Wilson, filmmakers, cultural critics and commentators like myself and Matt Walsh from The Daily Wire. Sign up at calledconference.ninja. Again, Moscow, Idaho, July 16th through the 20th, calledconference.ninja.
Hello and welcome to the New St. Andrews College podcast. My name is Ben Merkel. I'm the president of New St. Andrews College, and I am joined once again by Dr. Jonathan McIntosh.
Hello, Ben.
Hello. So today, this is our concluding episode with Dr. Mack, and we are finishing on Aquinas. Last week we did Cur Anselm, and so this week, how about we begin with Cur Aquinas? Why Aquinas? Why? Let me push that a little bit further. Not just why Aquinas in general. Why Aquinas in our context? We are a Protestant Reformed college, and Aquinas is a medieval philosopher who's seems to be claimed pretty heavily by the Catholic side. Why would a Protestant Reformed college be working through Aquinas?
Yeah. So, of course, one of the great cries of the Reformation was ad fontes, back to the sources. And of course, principally what that meant was back to the source of Scripture, our ultimate authority. But I think following on that is also back to the other sources God has given us throughout church history, and that includes great medieval thinkers, predecessors of the Reformation, figures like Anselm, whom we've talked about before, and also Aquinas. And I think Aquinas just is one of those resources that Protestants should go back and reappropriate, not uncritically. There's, of course, lots there for us to disagree with Aquinas over, but even those disagreements can be profoundly helpful and sharpening for us as Protestants.
Okay. And that is, I think, one of the things that I think at NSA that it has been kind of a central concern is that we want to go ahead and claim the whole Christian tradition, including the medieval era, and we're not going to say that Aquinas is a Catholic because he's ours, or not a Roman Catholic. I'll be more specific.
That's right, yeah.
Tell me, just Aquinas in general, what do you think is the, if you could summarize, and this is obviously a stretch to try to summarize Aquinas down into a few minutes, but what are the great contributions from Aquinas that you want to pull in to your teaching?
Yeah, so I think one that always comes to mind is Aquinas is a very careful and thorough thinker. He makes helpful distinctions, sometimes makes some unhelpful ones, but generally he's a master of making distinctions that are relevant, that illuminate a topic rather than obscure them. And he's a master of intellectual taxonomy. His powers of organization and synthesis are quite remarkable. And so I think he's a great model for, he's been a great model for me, and I think he's a great model for students, just in learning how to organize subject matter. When you approach a topic, it really matters the order in which you move through it. What do you need to cover first? What should you cover second? What should you cover third? And Aquinas was really a master teacher in that he gave a lot of thought to the order in which the subject matter, by its very nature, needs to be unfolded, but also just the structure of the human mind and the approach of the student and how a subject matter needs to be exposited in a way that leads them from what they know to what they don't know.
What's the connection between Aquinas's project and what you're working through in your courses? How do you use him in your teaching?
Yeah, well, he's connected to a number of different things. I, of course, did my dissertation on Tolkien and Aquinas, and so that's really where my interest in him began. But at present, we talked in another episode about the courses I'm doing in economics and politics, and I see Aquinas as being connected to those as well. Economics and politics, at least as I approach them in my classes here at NSA, they are sciences of human action. But if we want to understand human action, we need to ultimately see it against the backdrop of God and God's own action. And so this course that I'm teaching, for example, this term at NSA is Aquinas on God. It's Aquinas' doctrine of God. And one of the themes we're focusing on in this class is the grammar and the logic of action that Aquinas introduces us to in the course of talking about God, because I think one of the things he's doing is equipping us to think more foundationally and philosophically about the structure and the logic of our own action, whether that's in the economic sphere or the political sphere or the ethical sphere or wherever.
You've put it quite positively, but if somebody wanted to push against you a bit on that, Aquinas is he's fairly synonymous with medieval scholasticism, and the caricature of that is that it is this elevation of reason and philosophical logic chopping over revelation, faith, and so what you end up is philosophy sort of displacing theology. What do you say to that objection?
Yeah, I think it's first, I'm very sympathetic to that concern. There is such a thing as rationalism, and for Christians to forget back to what we were talking about earlier, ad fontes, back to the sources, to forget mm-hmm. our foundation. And I think there are respects in which the scholastic tradition to which Aquinas belonged in places became guilty of that. For Aquinas himself, at least I think properly understood, as he himself presents it in the Summa Theologiae, his magnum opus, at the beginning of the Summa, when he's talking about God and what reason can know about God, what the careful reader will observe is that Aquinas is actually profoundly impressed by the limits of human reason and what we can know about God. So he begins, for example, by saying that, he's asking the question, granted that we have philosophy, what do we need theology for? Given that all the things that we can know about God through reason, why do we need revelation? And Aquinas's answer is, it, on the one hand, it sounds very Aristotelian and philosophical, but it's really a chastening of human reason. He says, man is ordered towards God by nature as to an end that actually surpasses the grasp of our knowledge. We, by our own powers of reason, can't know God, and yet we're made to know God. So we must know him. By nature, we're driven to know him. And by our own nature and our natural abilities, and that includes the natural ability of reason, we can't know him. And so there's got to be something. That's the problem. And so we need revelation. Even where reason is competent, Aquinas thinks it's very limited in what we can know about God. So he says that even those things we can know about God through reason, we can only know it after a really long time. It's only known by a very elite few, and even then, it's mixed up with a lot of error. So there again, we can see that Aquinas wasn't terribly impressed by what reason could know about God. And then finally, the thing I would point to is when you open up the Summa and you look through all the things that Aquinas is proving about God. He's proving that God exists. He's proving traditional doctrines like God's simplicity and his immutability and his infinity and his eternity. And it looks very, very rationalistic. Look at all these things reason can show us. But what Aquinas explains at the beginning is we actually can't know what God is. We can all we can do is know what he is not, at least by the power of reason. So when Aquinas is using reason to show all these things about God, the way Aquinas himself understands it is this is reason showing what we can't know about God, how reason really is on a short leash. And so what reason is really limited to is really defining the boundaries of its own ignorance. And so I think viewed in that light, mm-hmm. You can see that Aquinas is well aware of the limits of reason and really our dependence and need for revelation.
So is the 16th century Reformation, or was the 16th century Reformation then the eclipsing of Aquinas' project, or what continuing on from Aquinas is useful within a reform framework?
Well, we're getting a little bit outside of my area of specialty, but as I understand it, the Reformation and the Reformed theologians were profoundly influenced by Aquinas. They obviously had to situate him in a new Reformation context where Scripture is put frontmost in Christian thinking. His thought was very influential and instrumental in how the Reformed approached a lot of their own theological thinking.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I noticed or that was impressed upon me the most when you were describing just the sense in which Aquinas gave us the vocabulary for and the taxonomy for breaking down these kinds of discussions that seems to be fairly quickly after the Reformers established the foundation of the faith, then those skills all come right back in and are necessary for breaking out the reform systematics. And you see pretty quickly on in the Reformation a return to a lot of Aquinas' categories and language to be able to express what's going on in Reformed theology.
The Reformed scholastic I'm probably most familiar with would be Francis Turretin. You can't go far in his institutes without finding him citing Aquinas.
Right. We talked in a different episode about Anselm's argument for God's existence, and we connected that a little bit to in what ways is that like what we think of as presuppositional apologetics, and what ways is it not like that. I'm curious how your take on Aquinas' approach to the question of God's existence then fits in here.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Aquinas actually does read Anselm and his argument for God's existence as you might describe it as a proto-presuppositional argument, and he critiques it on that on those grounds. Aquinas was not presuppositionalist and would have been hostile to it for reasons I'll maybe comment in a moment. But he does read Anselm that way. As to how Aquinas would relate to presuppositional apologetics. So Aquinas does not begin his thinking about God, or at least his treatise on God, with the fact of God's existence. He begins with arguments for it. So before we talk about God, we first need to establish that this thing exists. So he begins with five arguments, his famous five ways for God's existence. And the way he argues is he argues from the world around us. And that's very important for Aquinas because on his understanding of the human mind and how the human mind was made, we are first and foremost incarnate beings. We're not angels. We're not pure spirits. We're not pure minds. We are incarnate beings. And that means the way in which we are to know, and that includes know God's existence, at least in terms of our natural powers, is first by observing the world around us through our senses, and then taking that experience and drawing out certain conclusions from it. So all of his arguments begin with experience of the world, and he argues accordingly. So he's not presuppositional. In fact, what he would say, I think, about presuppositional arguments is that the problem is the presuppositional position mistakes our human psychology and epistemology, our human ways of knowing, with what Aquinas would actually describe as angelic ways of knowing. The angels are not embodied the way we are, and so they think very differently. And I think Aquinas would say they do think presuppositionally. They just see God in his essence and then see everything else following from that. But as embodied beings, that's not how we are made. And for Aquinas, it's not. Sometimes he's accused, or classical apologetics is accused of giving way to neutrality, and that it's an autonomous way of thinking about God's existence. But for Aquinas, once again, he argues for God's existence in the way that he does because he's impressed with the limitations of the human mind. We just aren't really smart enough to begin with certain presuppositions and work from there. We are these creatures who walk around on the earth, and all of our knowledge sort of begins there.
Mm. Last week when we concluded our discussion of Anselm, you gave us the shallow end in which we ought to wade into Anselm. I'm curious if there is a shallow end for Aquinas. So if a listener said, okay, I need to get me some Aquinas, where does that begin? How would you handhold through that?
Yeah, in this case, I probably wouldn't tell them to go directly to Aquinas, although get there as soon as you can. A couple of sources that I think would be really helpful in capturing the spirit of Aquinas's work that I would recommend, and they're short readings and really delightful readings that would prepare a person for reading Aquinas. And that would be, on the one hand, G.K. Chesterton's very famous and delightful biography mm-hmm. of St. Thomas Aquinas. It's just called St. Thomas Aquinas, the Dumb Ox. Chesterton gives a really insightful and delightful intro to Aquinas and his thought and what animated him. The second thing I would direct people to would be another short work by a 20th century German Thomist by the name of Joseph Pieper, P-I-E-P-E-R, titled The Silence of St. Thomas. And this was actually the work that helped me as a Protestant, as Reformed, and to really appreciate Aquinas's thought. And his argument is that whether it's spoken or not, in the said or the unsaid, one of the animating doctrines behind all of Aquinas's thinking is really the doctrine of creation, that God is the God of existence. He is the God who is being. He's the source of everything, and everything else is a creature of him and is therefore revelatory of God. And it's really that creator-creature distinction that Pieper argues is behind Aquinas's thought, driving it to all of its conclusions. And I think that's right. So after those two sources, then I would say just open up the Summa Theologiae and good luck.
Dive in. And then perhaps maybe Silmarillion in between. Does that the other?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I know that was your gateway, right?
That's right, yeah. Tolkien's a great commentary on Aquinas. So yeah, maybe Tolkien's creation myth, the Ainu Lindale at the beginning of the Silmarillion. You can't go wrong there.
Okay. Thanks very much. It's been a delight to speak with you these four episodes.
Thank you, Ben.
And thank you for listening to this podcast. We hope you join us next week.